From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it was a winding road that took Roger Ferguson through life to where he is now, CEO of the financial services firm TIAA.
My path was not predictable or direct. And so I always tell people that there's no such thing as a career ladder. It's more like a rock climbing wall or the children's jungle gym out in the playground.
Later, an Arctic explorer explains why he and his partner decided to take their children along for their expeditions.
Part of the motivation for that was actually the opportunity to take our kids out there with us so they can experience these incredible travels and these parts of our planet.
Novelist Cynthia Swanson's latest period piece is set in 1960s Door County.
And Bel Canto Chorus presents a concert about Milwaukee's immigrant experience. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The tax and regulatory environment has been changing a lot over the past year and a half in this country. For Roger Ferguson, the changes are affecting both his company and the people it serves.
Ferguson is CEO of TIAA, the retirement and financial services firm that largely serves people in education and nonprofit sectors. Ferguson was in Milwaukee earlier this spring, and we caught up with him then. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
TIAA was founded and run for a long time as a nonprofit. It has gone through changes in more recent years. How do you see the evolution of the company since you have been running it?
Well, the evolution of the company has two components. One is things that have changed, and one is things that have not changed. So what has not changed is that we still have our not-for-profit heritage, and our charter calls for us to operate in that fashion. We still are primarily focused on providing financial well-being for individuals and the not-for-profit sector. What has changed is we are building out capabilities that include retirement, which is our core service, but adding more, including banking, life insurance. Here in Wisconsin, we are involved in the 529 program, for example. And so what really has evolved over time is we've become a more of a full-service financial services firm, but with the same culture, the same heritage, the same values, and the same history.
And still geared largely towards working with people in the nonprofit world?
Still absolutely geared towards folks in the not-for-profit world, higher education, medical, cultural, and research. That's our home base.
The watchword in the financial and really many other industries in the last couple of years has been uncertainty. How much more certainty do you have now about the economic and tax climate after 14 months of the current administration and the way the economy is shaping up?
I think the watchword is always change. So there has been greater certainty around tax law because that's now been signed into law. But the places of uncertainty have to do with what looks like now a very positive macroeconomic environment. But one always has to be aware that the markets have been very, very strong for almost a decade now. And so many of us are observing and asking sort of questions around how long that's going to last. Personally, I think we've got some way to go in terms of reasonably good stock market performance, but we have seen an uptick in volatility of late. And so I'd say this is the time to be optimistic that good times will continue, but one should not be complacent.
I don't know exactly how old you are, but certainly as I was coming of age, the idea of planning for retirement was a salient one, seemingly no matter what your social strata was. I don't necessarily know that I see that from my view anymore. What are you seeing in terms of current attitudes towards saving for retirement among different generations?
I think you put your finger on it by saying it varies from generation to generation. For those of us who are older and aging baby boomers, we are now entering retirement, and so retirement is really front and center in our thinking. For the millennials, I think they are focused on getting started. They have a number of financial issues and challenges. In some cases, it's student debt. Others are, getting married and starting a household. But those who have jobs, I would absolutely encourage them to put saving for retirement as one of the things that they're focused on, because they will eventually get to a place where they're going to need those retirement savings. For those that are in the middle, I've observed that they are also focused on, as we aging baby boomers are, starting the process of saving for retirement as they're getting, you know, other parts of their financial lives in order.
You know, given the mission of TIAA and it's so many, it's multiple connections with higher education institutions, I imagine you have cause to meet younger people who are either in college or just getting out of college. And I wonder what you hear from them, the kinds of questions that they ask you most often.
Well, indeed, I do have cause to talk to younger people. I was just on the campus of the University of Wisconsin of Madison recently, and I heard a number of things. One is they are very interested in what are the lessons that we in the older generation can give them about their financial lives. So they are curious about that, contrary to what many people might say as a generalization. Secondly, they recognize the value of education. Again, I am talking to people who are on college campuses. And they're all also very interested in, you know, careers, career projections, how one develops a career and moves forward. So I'm very optimistic from the conversations I'm hearing with young people on campuses.
How were your own attitudes about retirement shaped by your upbringing?
I was very, very lucky to grow up in a household that valued both education and financial literacy. But one of the things I saw, particularly with my father, was saving and investing with a long-term perspective, knowing that retirement would be looming in the future, was an important lesson. And indeed, my father was very financially literate, didn't have much money, but he managed to actually take an early retirement from his job and lived on his own resources in retirement for almost 30 years.
Do I remember reading, was he a cartographer?
Yes, my father was a cartographer, a civilian map maker for the U.S. Army.
Well, and there seems to be something about that world that you know, when you are drawing maps for a living, you have to be able to understand the connections from one thing to another.
Absolutely. My father was very, very analytical. And as you point out, the ability to sort of see those kinds of connections carried over into him being very, very interested in financial matters as well. Very logical, very grounded, and very analytical.
There's a reason the roadmap is a metaphor.
Exactly right.
Can you share a little bit about your own path to the place that you are today and what lessons people might draw from it?
Sure. The first thing I would share is my path was not predictable or direct. And so I always tell people that there's no such thing as a career ladder. It's more like a rock climbing wall or the, you know, the children's jungle gym out in the playground. You move left, you move right, you move up, you move down. So my career, I think, reflects that kind of uncertainty. The second element of my career that I think is relevant is it's really built around the amount of time I spent in higher ed. And so, you know, the other big lesson for me is you can build a very interesting, diverse 30, maybe 40-year career built off of making sure you invest in your own education up front.
Oh, I was just going to ask, and is there a certain amount of keeping your eyes open to those other handholds that you have to do?
Oh, absolutely. The way I describe that is a career is also involved in taking reasonable risks, you know, looking for those other handholds in a rock climbing wall analogy. And so being open to those opportunities when they present themselves, but making sure you're qualified to be successful. And that goes back to the issue of having ample education and building what we economists have called your own human capital.
Did I also remember reading correctly that, is it true that you cleaned bathrooms while you were in college?
Yes, it is. So my work-study job for the first 2 years in college was cleaning bathrooms. It was not in any sense a glamorous job. But the lesson I learned from that is that there is no job that is so small that you wouldn't want to do it well. And that's another thing that I've taken with me on my journey through my career over the last 40 years or so.
The bathrooms at Harvard were not nicer than any bathrooms anywhere else.
Bathrooms are bathrooms, and you can imagine bathrooms that are used by college students are probably a lot less nice than other bathrooms.
I don't really want to imagine them at all, actually.
Yes, exactly right.
What about the lessons about leadership that you have gotten from others play into what you're able to accomplish today?
I think the main lessons I've learned about leadership is that leadership is really about exciting and attracting followers. And so one has to say, what are the skills that it takes to really bring followers along behind you? And I see four things. One is you have to have expertise. Individuals don't follow an amateur. Secondly, you have to be able to describe where you want to go and articulate that well in a compelling way. The third thing I think is often surprising to people is I've seen the best leaders are very empathetic. You know, if you're going to work with other human beings and want them to follow you, you have to understand where they're coming from and recognize that they're just not cogs in your vision or your machine, but they've got their lives of their own. And the final element of leadership is around a certain amount of fortitude. The path is almost never straight. There are setbacks. And individuals don't want to follow a leader who is the first one to panic as soon as things don't go smoothly.
The number of African Americans running financial services firms is fairly low. Does that concern you? And are there things that you do to try to change that?
It absolutely is something I think should be of concern to all of us in the sense that we know that diversity and inclusion throughout an organization, including diverse perspectives at the top of the organization, can often lead to better outcomes and better changes and better solutions. And secondly, we understand that we live in a world that's really becoming more and more diverse, and so it's important for all businesses to reflect that. What I try to do to deal with that is to be, one, forthright about this as an issue. Two, hopefully I can serve as a bit of a role model. And I do spend a fair amount of my time on college campuses trying to interact with all sorts of students to indicate to everybody just by my presence that, you know, leadership comes in all sorts of shapes, sizes, and colors.
At some point do you stop noticing when you walk in the room that there are really not very many leaders of color?
I don't think that you ever really stop noticing that. The question is then how do you react to it? And my view is that you react to it by being the best leader you can possibly be. If you happen to be the only person of color in the room, then I think your job is to continue to do the best you can. You don't have to take the burden for the entire race, and you shouldn't feel, I think, in any sense stymied by being the only person of color in the room. The way I think about it is a relevant factor, but it's not the only factor.
Roger Ferguson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Roger Ferguson is CEO of the financial services firm TIAA. We spoke with him while he was in Milwaukee to speak at an event organized by the Lubar School of Business at UW-Milwaukee.
We'll take a short break now, and then we'll return with Canadian explorer Corey Trepanier, whose expeditions inspired an exhibition of his oil paintings and films called Into the Arctic. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There are parts of our planet where most of us will never have the opportunity to travel. But thanks to people like Corey Trepanier, we can still have the opportunity to see them.
Trepanier is an explorer, artist, and filmmaker whose traveling exhibition about his Arctic expeditions is currently on display at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay. Aptly named Into the Arctic, the exhibit features Trepanier's oil paintings and several documentaries about his expeditions. He just released the third installment of the films, Into the Arctic, The Last Chapter.
Trepanier and David Wagner, the producer and manager of the exhibition, met with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and Trepanier explained what his works add to our cultural understanding of the Arctic.
The places are so foreign that so few people will actually sort of encounter them in person. They're landscapes that are foreign, but they're beautiful in such an incredible way. So, I mean, I guess on the surface, they're pretty pictures. I hate to say that, but there's more to it than that, especially now as we look at this region and how it's been changing over the last number of years, the Inuit I've traveled with explaining how their lives have changed as a result of the climate changing there as well, that perhaps more now than ever, there's an opportunity to bring awareness to a landscape undergoing great change. And hopefully, as an artist, what I really aspire to is to help other people fall in love with these places a little. Because maybe then, that's the beginning of it. That's the beginning of people taking care of something as if they actually care about it in the first place. So for most people, it's an introduction. It's bringing it on their radar in the first place. But to know that these are real places, part of our incredible planet that we live on, and hopefully can inspire people to to get out and explore more and see for themselves and look at after it.
Your exhibits feature not only paintings but also these films. What do you think the films add to the paintings and vice versa? What do you think? How do you think these two things play off of one another?
I hope the films add some of the real experience that I had while traveling there. And I became a filmmaker after being an artist, if you will. I mean, it's always been about the art. And I start to realize as an artist, I could not capture everything of this experience on canvas, no matter how many paintings I did. And so I started to bring those experiences that I was having together in my films. And personally, it allowed me to tell so much more of a story, not only the story of where these pieces came from, but the whole larger ecosystem of what it is to actually explore these places. And so similarly, in the terms of the exhibition, the films are a really critical part. People have a chance to see the work actually beginning in the field, and I guess it lends to the authenticity of the art that they're seeing. But hopefully it helps to educate and inspire them with all the other peripheral things outside of the act of painting. As mentioned, the wildlife that I've encountered, polar bears, muskox, the Inuit people who I've traveled with, who have shared their culture with me and helped me to understand the land better, and spending that time one-on-one with them. And hopefully that will also bring an awareness of what it takes to live in the Arctic for these cultures who are having quite a challenge up there and these wonderful people. There's history as well, some that even American history I've encountered in the Canadian Arctic, like this place called Fort Conger, where Adolphus Greely went and explored in 1872 or something. And unfortunately, only 7 of 27 men returned. And it was the worst Arctic exploration disaster in American exploration history. And so there's so many different things that I've encountered as a human being while out painting that I just had to start bringing those things together and sharing stories that hopefully connect people even more.
David, as someone who is on the outside of this, who isn't exploring this, but is very familiar with artwork and in your line of work, how do you curate this material for different audiences? Because I imagine people in North America at least kind of peripherally understand this kind of landscape. They know it's there at least. Is it different when you go to European audiences, or is it really the same?
I think that's the same. When the exhibition premiered at the Embassy of Canada, a requirement of Canadian government is that exhibition labels and text materials be bilingual. And so the exhibition has a text in French and English, and generous text authored by Corey himself to describe and narrate the pictures to enable viewers to really get inside the pictures, the paintings. And that's a helpful tool because, of course, you may stand in front of a painting and appreciate its beauty in terms of composition, design, use of color, and so forth. But in addition to artistic elements and principles of design, Corey's provided an inside track of information to allow people to get inside each particular artwork. And the narrative on the labels is quite informative, interesting, and engaging.
You mentioned about different regions interacting with the work. It's been very interesting for me after a decade of essentially creating this collection in private, up in my barn, north of Toronto in Caledon, to have it go before the public. And after this decade of doing this, and I was wondering myself, how will people respond to the work, and how will they respond to it in different regions? So the exhibition, just about a year ago, went to Tucson, Arizona. I'd never been to Arizona before. It was a great excuse. One of the wonderful things about the tour is I've got to see so much more of our neighbors than I've ever seen before. And so when I went to Arizona in the Sonoran Desert, it was approaching 40 degrees Celsius. And I thought, how are people going to react to these images of the far north, of the very northern end of North America? Ice, you know, icebergs, glaciers, and it's not all that. There's also tundra. And what I found was that as I was there talking to visitors coming through, people were extremely engaged. I mean, not only there was there a high level of environmental awareness amongst the visitors because of the nature of the particular venue in the museum, but also it's a desert there. It's a completely opposite kind of desert. There's cactus, it's extreme, and places I've gone to in the high Arctic are classified as polar deserts, sand and very little precipitation. So here we have two kinds of deserts, completely opposite. And people found it fascinating to be able to have this unique insight into this part of the world. But I also realized that that same feedback I'm getting from pretty well everybody I talked to in Canada. I mean, we had a Canadian premiere in Vancouver, and the north of Canada, for most Canadians is probably just as could be the moon, just as much as it was for somebody in Arizona. And so it seems like it's an opportunity for everybody anywhere to connect with this part of the world because it is so unique. And Canadians know it's there, but very few ever get to see it themselves. So
now, this is the third installment, really, of this series, Into the Arctic. And it's the last part of it, or it seems to be the last part of it.
Into the Arctic 3 is the final chapter of my film series, the completion of the trilogy that I started a decade ago alongside all the paintings. So Into the Arctic 3, the last chapter, is this last 90-minute documentary that I've just completed that encompasses my last major expedition, which was almost 9 weeks across the Arctic, in a bid to fulfill a few more canvases to add to the tour, to complete the tour, and also includes some of the story of the actual exhibition going to Washington. And I just returned about a week and a half ago from Monaco, where we had the privilege of showing Into the Arctic 3. I'm losing count, but it is the last one. but we were invited by Prince Albert II Foundation, and we had the opportunity to screen the film for the first time before Prince Albert II and a number of others in Monaco. And so that film is just sort of starting its own life. It will be joining the tour, but we've entered it into major film festivals and everything else. So in the coming months, that film tells, I guess, the completion of the story. Meanwhile, the exhibition itself continues to tour for a couple more years.
So is this footage from earlier explorations? Is this...
It's from my last major expedition. So I initially did 3 expeditions to the Arctic, each range from a month to 2.5 months. And then a couple of years ago, I returned to the Arctic for my 4th expedition. And the footage from that 4th expedition from 2015, along with our filming at the Embassy of Canada, got all woven together to tell the final sort of story of this project that actually began a decade ago. So we reach back with some early footage a little bit here and there as well. So it's really, while the other films are more sort of expedition-based, this one carries a story arc that goes over a decade in length.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things I found in my research of you is you do a lot of these expeditions with your wife, but also your children, starting off when they were very little. What is that experience like, going around with a 5-year-old, a 2-year-old?
Oh, well, it's been amazing. We started to do my fine art as a career. I was doing commercial art for about 10 years, painting for ad agencies and magazine covers and so on. And I really started to fall in love with the process of taking an easel out and just painting. This was between my commercial projects. And our girls were 2.5 and 5 years old. And it really became important to me to pursue my fine art. And I had fallen in love with a place called Lake Superior. Probably heard of that. It's massive. I went up there for a project for a couple of weeks and got a taste of it and said, you know, I really, really want to pursue my fine art. And the only way to do this seriously is I can't go for a weekend here, weekend there. And so we devised a project that would allow me to go paint for a month in each season on the coast of Lake Superior in Georgian Bay in Canada. When I started looking at that, I said, I can't leave my kids for a month. Certainly Janet won't leave him for a month. And so he said, okay, this is a family trip. This is what, and part of the motivation for that was actually the opportunity to take our kids out there with us so they can experience these incredible travels and these parts of our planet. And so it became a family journey, and we encountered all kinds of amazing experiences throughout that. So when the Arctic came on my radar, and in 2006, I decided, okay, this is the next big thing I want to do with my career. I want to paint these places that are so alluring. We devised it as a family expedition as well. The girls were then 7 and 11, and we left home and didn't come back for 2.5 months. And the girls were not only part of the expedition, but they were active participants in that. We have a blog section on the website where we said to our girls, Andy was 11, said, look, you know, we're not just dragging you around here. We want you to experience this and then try to put back into words to share it with other people, because not many kids your age will ever get a chance to do this. And they took it to heart, and she wrote like 25 little stories, and we did little video journals with them and all that. And so it was really an incredible family experience. They sensed for the first time in their life isolation from family and friends. We were out in the remote landscape in the tent, fog all around us for miles. So it was really, as a family unit, an incredible experience to bind us together further. And although we were not able to to really take them on some of the subsequent Arctic expeditions due to logistics and due to, well, concern over safety as well, hanging out in polar bear country with shotgun in your tent at night and that kind of stuff. I was really glad the kids weren't there. I'm thrilled that this summer our youngest, who was 7, who's now 19, will be joining me back in the Arctic for a two-week hike over 100 kilometers on Baffin Island through these glaciers and kilometer-high granite walls. And so, yeah, we have a little return visit coming up, which I'm thrilled about.
Do you plan to film that?
Well, actually, you know, I initially thought about it. And every time I've gone to the Arctic, it's been with camera in tow with the intention of creating a film. And I decided, you know, I just finished Into the Arctic 3. It was a huge endeavor. I've got a new film coming out all this year, A. And B, the opportunity to have 2 weeks with my 19-year-old, I may never get this opportunity again, and I don't want the distraction of filming it seriously. Now, of course, we're still going to bring a camera with us. and actually, Sydney's interested in doing blogs herself, and we'll be doing some stuff for the web, but not to create a film per se. Hopefully so, create a lot of personal memories, too.
A little bit of a break.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me about your work, and thanks for visiting Milwaukee.
Wow, it's been a thrill. We came over on the big lake ferry, Lake Express. It felt like the Arctic weather was like freezing up on there, but it was so beautiful to come across. And our first visit ever, we've been given a fantastic tour with Dave and love it.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joy.
Corey Trepanier is an artist and filmmaker, and David Wagner is the producer and manager of Trepanier's traveling exhibit named Into the Arctic.
The exhibition features Trepanier's oil paintings and documentaries of his expeditions, including his most recent and final addition to the show, Into the Arctic 3, The Last Chapter. His work will be on display at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay through mid-August.
Wisconsin native Cynthia Swanson's latest book is set in the Door County and New York of the 1960s. We'll find out why those places and that decade appeal to her when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We first talked with writer and Wisconsin native Cynthia Swanson a few years ago when her debut novel, The Bookseller, was published. It went on to become an award-winning New York Times bestseller. The book took place in the Denver of the early 1960s, a time in history Swanson finds fascinating.
So it's no surprise that her latest book, The Glass Forest, is also set in that era, although it's New York and in Door County, Wisconsin, rather than Denver. The book came out in February, and Swanson joined us via Skype ahead of an appearance in Milwaukee, and she explained why this era captures her imagination.
You know, I think a lot of it is just the social fabric was so interesting, and all of the changes that were going on. There was just enormous social changes going on all over the country, for women especially. Women's lives were changing so much, and I find that fascinating, and especially now where you look at kind of the social climate that we have going on in our times, and I feel like we're going through a lot of changes now too. And so there's some parallels, and there's some places where we can learn from history what we want to do differently and the mistakes that we don't want to repeat.
And you've embodied these changes in a couple of really interesting characters. There's the younger character of Angie, and then there's also, I won't even call her middle-aged because she's not even quite that old, but the character of Celia, who is somewhat of an anomaly in this time frame. She's a working woman.
Right. And a businesswoman and, you know, very prosperous. So not just working outside the home, but really supporting her family.
And wanting to. I mean, yeah. it's partially driven by some things that are happening in her home, but also it's part of who she wants to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's 38 years old at the time of the story. So not middle-aged quite, but at that time, having gone through her life, went to college and began a career because of circumstances with her family, and her husband ends up raising their daughter. So it's a very, very different kind of family situation than a lot of people have. But it ends up, yeah, evolving into really what she wants in a lot of ways as far as her lifestyle. I think when she's younger, it's a quandary for her. She feels like she wants to be home and raise babies, and it just doesn't turn out that way. But then she finds some power in who she becomes.
Yeah, I really liked her. And there was this interesting kind of, she's Finnish by heritage. And so there's, you bring in a lot of that expatriate community in New York. This happens to be in Brooklyn at the time. And the kinds of things she was both raised in, but also leaving behind.
Yeah, it was really interesting researching that Finnish heritage for her. I really kind of came across it by accident. I needed her to be from Brooklyn. I needed her to be a second generation American and have some ethnicity, but I didn't want her to be, for reasons of the story, I didn't want her to be Jewish and I didn't want her to be Catholic. And that turned out to actually be a really tall order to find a good heritage for her. But I'd sort of discovered these Finnish socialists in Brooklyn, and it was just this small pocket community of people, but it was very, very active in the socialist movement in the early part of the 20th century. And it worked perfectly for her character and for the character of her mother and for how her family structure came together and who she became. So it was just one of those pieces that really fell into place nicely.
Well, it was so interesting to read because I knew nothing about them, you know, and I thought, wow. And it's one of those, as you say, these little pocket stories that there's all over the place, but you just don't know. And it added such a rich texture to the entire story, because one of the things, you know, mentioned the socialist background, one of the things that is in conflict here is that idea of capitalism versus communism and socialism. And
correct.
And it's both a background noise in the novel, but it's also almost a protagonist too.
Yeah, it's very present for all of the characters in the way that their lives are structured and what goes on and how their lives change. Again, it comes back to that, why that 50s, 60s time period is so interesting to me, because there was so much of that kind of change going on. And people were threatened by certain ways that other people felt about lifestyles and how they wanted to live and what they wanted the country to look like. Some people felt very threatened by that, and I found that very interesting as well.
Well, of course, you know, Wisconsin being the home of McCarthy and the witch hunts and all of that sort of stuff, which by the time this book has taken place, they are more or less over.
Right.
But we're, you know, the country is still living with that legacy. And of course, one of the protagonists of the book is from Wisconsin and Door County.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah. Angie is 21 years old and she is from Bailey's Harbor, born and raised there. I got asked this by my Wisconsin family, you know, why did you pick Door County and Bailey's Harbor for her hometown? And we have family friends who have a place on North Bay. So we've spent a lot of time there, my family and I have. And I needed her to be not just from a small town, but I really wanted her to be from somewhere really idyllic. So it had to be a Wisconsin place that had a strong sense of place that people in the Midwest would recognize, oh, Door County, who doesn't love Door County? And feel like, okay, she got to go and leave and she thought she was having this great adventure, but really she spends most of the novel wanting to get back there. And really, who wouldn't, right?
You know, so. Well, except when you're 21, you know, even if you grew up in paradise, you want to leave it.
Sure. She thought she did. She wanted to go see what the world looked like. She got to go to New York and she thought that was pretty exciting at first. And then she realizes how much she misses home.
She grows up a lot in this book. And so even though she wants to go back and eventually does, I don't think we're giving anything away by saying that she does eventually head back, but she is forever changed.
Right.
And brings that change with her, even though we don't know yet at the end of the book, we don't know how that might manifest in her life going forward.
I think with my books, I've realized something that with my themes all start with CON. In The Bookseller, I feel like contentment was the theme. And in this book, I feel like confidence is the theme. And especially for Angie, that's something that she develops over time. She doesn't really have that when she starts out. And then as she goes through this experience, she really finds out who she is and grows a lot in her confidence in herself.
Well, and you talk about confidence, and another protagonist in the book is Ruby, who is a teenager when we meet her, and is, what is this? She's a niece, right? She's Angie's niece.
She's Angie's niece, yes.
Right. And she has a confidence that sort of belies her years.
Correct. Yes. She has a confidence that is like no one else that she will ever meet. She's a mystery, and she's supposed to be a mystery. It's intentional. Although we do hear narration through her viewpoint, there's always an underlying sense that Ruby's not even telling us everything as readers. Whereas Angie and Celia really pretty much lay it out for us over time. But with Ruby, we kind of feel like maybe she's holding back and we only find out what Ruby wants to tell us. And that's that sort of innate confidence that she's always had. She just had it as intuition more than anything, I think.
We've talked about the three main female characters. We haven't talked about the male characters, and they are equally as important and drive the story in their own ways, but they are very different, and you've drawn them all very differently, starting with the two brothers, and then, of course, then there's Dr. Shepherd.
So the two brothers, it's Henry and Paul, and they are less than a year apart in age. They look almost exactly alike, but they're very different in demeanor. Paul is the younger brother, and he's charming, and he is a ladies' man, and he kind of knows how to sort of win the hearts of everybody around him, and that's Angie's husband, and he's 17 years older than Angie. So she meets him. He shows up out of nowhere in Door County and starts bartending at Gordon Lodge, and that's where they meet, and these painting on the side, and she just becomes captivated by him, and they get married and have a baby, and she feels like she's found her perfect match.
She's won the lotto.
I mean, she got like the guy that no one else in her hometown got, so she just feels like this is it. I won. And then there's Henry, and Henry is married to Celia. They marry very young. They meet during World War II when he's on leave in New York City, and they have a whirlwind romance and get married, and then he ships out. And she's left, and she's pregnant with Ruby. And he comes back several years later from the war, and it's clear that he has suffered some trauma when he's there, although he won't talk about what happened. You know, these days he would be identified and diagnosed with PTSD, but back then that didn't happen very often for too many returning GIs. And so he really suffers mentally, and he closes down a lot. So he becomes somebody... Again, and maybe that's a little bit where Ruby gets that too, is from maybe that's the nurture part, is she watches him close down and she knows that he just doesn't give away very many pieces of himself. And that's how he lives, and that's who he becomes.
Obviously the book is a thriller and kind of a mystery, and we find out most things at the end. There's still a few little things left up in the air. Were you just trying to take us on a really interesting ride there, or was there something else that you want us to take away from this book?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's a thriller. And the way that I've heard it described by several people who reviewed it so far is that it's a character-driven thriller. And I think that is important as a distinction, in that I feel like if we're going to have a thriller, I love that being on the edge of your seat and having that suspense in a story. But I also really want that to be driven by who the people are. I want to know about their motivations. It's not a whodunit, it's a whydunit. So it's not a mystery. It's not like, oh, you know, did the butler do it? It's, well, what drove these people to end up where they did? How did we end up getting this to happen? And so those pieces unfold really slowly in kind of a slow burn situation. And that was intentional. I didn't want to write a book that followed all the formulas of a regular mystery. It has some of those elements, but I really wanted to explore the personalities and the characters of all of these different people that are involved in the story.
Did you know when you first started where it was going to end up, or did that kind of reveal itself to you as you went along?
I had a little bit of a sense, but because it's such a plot-driven story, I had to work really carefully to make sure all those pieces fell into place. And when I started writing it, I was writing it. It alternates or varies in chapter between Celia and Ruby and Angie, and I started writing it that way, and then I realized partway through that first draft that I really had to get Celia's story down, because Celia's the one who gives us the background, and she's missing, so we're sort of getting these stories of the history from this missing woman as the story progresses, and I needed to know her whole story before I could tell the current story happening in 1960, which is we're getting through the viewpoint of Angie and Ruby. So I had to really pull together a lot of pieces. I learned a lot writing this book. It really stretched me as a writer. It's very different from The Bookseller, and the process of writing it was very, very different from writing The Bookseller.
Interesting that you say that from your perspective. From mine as a reader, yes, they are very different books, but there's also a voice through them that I recognize as yours. And I think it's that care of character, that care of why these people, because I felt the same way in the bookseller. I cared about what happened to these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I wanted, yeah. It's not just like, oh, they were cogs in a wheel and everything kind of came out. I really wanted to know, and some things, you know, that happen in the glass forest, I think, oh, really? Darn it. or oh, really? Wow. That's really cool. You know,
right.
Because I wasn't really expecting that, and I had gotten invested in
right.
who these people were. And so I would say maybe that's what ties the books together is that care, that authorial care.
Most definitely. And that goes back to wanting to write character-driven stories. And in a lot of ways, it was the same with the bookseller, is that you know, something happened and it's a woman caught between a dream life and a real life. Well, that's cool, but what's the why? Why would that happen to somebody? How could a person get in that situation? And that's what unfolds in the bookseller, in the same way that this one is a thriller and we've got a mysteriously missing woman and a guy who's committed suicide and then a group of characters who have to deal with the fallout. Well, why? What happened? Why did he commit suicide? Why is she missing? Why did she run away? How did this all come together? And that all has to do with those characters and those personalities and making sure everybody is doing what would make sense for that particular character.
Do you have any idea? I know this has just been published, but I mean, there are some loose ends here. Do you think that there might be future books with other characters?
I don't know. We'll see. I tend to like my stories to finish up, so hopefully this one finished up relatively satisfyingly. I know that there could be places where they might get revisited or maybe they'll make a cameo in another book.
Well, you and I both know exactly the character we're talking about, and I'm not going to say more than that, but right. I think that would be a really wonderful cameo or possibly another book. So, right. Cynthia Swanson, it has been great talking with you. I am so looking forward to our conversation on the 15th at Boswell Book Company, but until then, safe travels.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure.
Wisconsin native Cynthia Swanson's latest book is called The Glass Forest. She joined us by Skype ahead of a February appearance in Milwaukee. You'll find links to more information about the book at www.wisconsin.com.
We will take one last break and then learn about The Immigrant Experience as performed by Milwaukee's Bel Canto Chorus. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's Bel Canto Chorus has been making music for almost 90 years. Begun in 1931, the organization has offered local singers a chance to perform a wide repertoire at a high standard.
As a part of the community in which it performs, the group has always presented concerts that reflect on current events. And this Wednesday's concert, The Immigrant Story, is no exception. Conceived by artistic director Richard Hinson, the performance will present a range of choral works interspersed with stories narrated by Mary Alice Tierney. Both of them join me in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah. This is such an interesting concert because we are at a point in our history where immigration is a dirty word.
Yes.
And immigrant is a dirty word, yet we are a nation of immigrants. Rick, what was the genesis of this concert? Did you want to address that in some way?
Well, choral music concerts often are topical, and we had had such success exploring the history of the Civil War. Both the beginning, the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War, and then 4 years later, the end of the Civil War. It was such a compelling program that we looked for other topical subjects that would be of interest to our listeners. And the immigrant story is now controversial. And actually, it has always been controversial. But we don't see that because immigration has happened in waves in our country. So in looking at this program, I chose to look at the foundation of immigration, which was from the beginning all the way up to about the beginning of the First World War. And that is what set the stage for then further waves of immigration.
So when you talk about the beginning of immigration in this country, we're really talking about, well, you could go back to the Danes, the Norse.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But, you know, probably the English would be the first.
Right.
You know, or the British Isles.
Right. And so what I did is, you know, it's a very funny road one takes as trying to combine interesting stories, because history is just telling stories, right, is combining an interesting story with an interesting piece of music. So to balance these two out, because this is a concert, the point was to find those compelling stories and combine them with really powerful pieces and pieces that people know. We're doing everything from the chorus of the Beer Barrel Polka, which everybody gets to sing, all the way to several movements from the Mozart Requiem. We're doing Wagner. We're doing Funiculi Funicula. We're doing pieces that people will recognize because it's part of our cultural heritage.
Thanks to immigrants.
Thanks to immigrants. Yeah. Exactly.
So, Mary Alice, you are the storyteller in
yes.
all of this. So how have you been working with Rick and with the chorus to develop the stories? Have you been writing them out? How has that worked?
Well, actually, Rick did the history and authored the narration, and the two of us have been working on it
right.
sort of online for a few weeks. And then I have had the privilege of being in some of the rehearsals, which is, for me, like heaven. It's heaven. And the opportunity to do some of this narration over music, humming. My goal is to weave the narration into the music so that it's all a seamless story for the people in the audience. And of course, the music is magnificent. I get swept away in the rehearsals just listening to the chorus.
Well, that's the fun part about being in a chorus and being around a chorus
exactly.
is the human voice in all of those harmonies.
Well, and what's so powerful, Bonnie, is that so we have you hear now how mellifluous Mary Alice's voice is,
mm-hmm.
and she tells these stories in such a powerful, vulnerable way. I mean, she welcomes you in, and the music then we play off one another because the music reflects what she's just said. And we're performing this at the Irish Community Center. So, of course, we're doing some Irish pieces, which for Mary Alice Tierney, the Tierney family, that's really appropriate.
I think the thing about choral singing is the fact that you're doing it in a community.
Mm-hmm.
We are community animals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to be in group and community.
Exactly.
And this is another way to do that when we unite voices.
Right.
And I think that's also a really interesting way to think about the whole immigrant experience
mm-hmm.
as well, is because we are stronger as a group.
Absolutely. And what was so key about and as I learned about the immigrant story, specifically about Wisconsin, was stunning to me how things that I know about today, businesses and streets and the evolution of Milwaukee itself from Juneau Town and Kilbourne Town to become the city of Milwaukee, all of these historical details weave themselves into an incredible fabric of contemporary life. I mean, we still eat Usinger sausage. We still drink Pabst beer. Now, things have changed a lot. It's not brewed here anymore, but it started here. There's so many things that started here, and that's, I think, what connects us all. When we see that, you know, we live in this community, but we're part of a community that's, you know, 200 years old. And that procession of generations is what's so exciting. And so interesting to hear about.
Well, and it's changing. You know, there's all new immigrant groups mm-hmm. who are coming and are changing mm-hmm. the smells and the tastes and the sounds
right.
of the city and will be incorporated into the history of this place.
Right.
And, you know, we walk on history every day. And so it's interesting to kind of be witness to the creation of it.
Right.
As
right.
well.
So true.
So why did you decide to end at the First World War? Was it just time?
Well, partly it's time.
Yeah.
This is a manageable time. The number of pieces of music that we're doing is a little bit more than we usually do. And then when you add the narration in, you know, we didn't want people to have to go out for supper between acts. So what I did was I looked at the history and saw that, you know, the major waves of immigration happened in Wisconsin. They trickled in up until about the 1830s and 40s, and then the Norwegians came, the Germans came, the Poles came, the Italians came. And in having those different groups coming in during that period of about 80 years, the foundation of our population was established. Just to give you an example, in Wisconsin, but in Milwaukee particularly, 40% of the population has a German connection. In the rest of the United States, it's only 17%. And that shows you that this concentration of Germanic culture really still speaks to us today. And what's also interesting is that at that time in the 1880s, Milwaukee was seen as a Germanic destination. It was called the German Athens.
So Mary Alice, did you learn anything in particular as you were working on this with Rick that you thought, I had no idea?
Actually, a lot of things. But the biggest lesson is one that I think we all know, but we don't revisit very often, which is all of these groups of people came here because they were being persecuted, because they couldn't practice their faith and their cultures, or for economic reasons. They experienced tremendous hardship getting here, took enormous risks, and life wasn't easy when they got here. But it was worth it for them, for their children and their children's children. As you said earlier, this is, you know, what we're living today is an echo of what all of our grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents experienced. It's a story that needs to be told over and over and over again so we don't forget that we're a nation of immigrants.
I like that imagery, the echo. Yeah. The echo of what has come before. Yeah, yeah, that's wonderful.
Right. And then the echoes of things to come. Mm-hmm. I mean, things that are happening right now and as we, again, change.
Right. And if this is as popular as I think it might be, you know, this is just the first chapter. What we weren't able to touch on is in World War I and then again in World War II, waves of people moved from different parts of the United States. And you see how the southern part of the city has gone from an essentially Polish neighborhood to Hispanic. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's what makes our city so vibrant.
Well, yes. I am looking forward to this. And so this is chapter one. There's other chapters to be singing
absolutely.
About.
There's so much to tell.
So much to tell. And I am so happy that you both came in, Mary Alice and Rick. It is great to see you. Best of luck with the concert.
Thank you so much.
Richard Hinson is the artistic director of the Bel Canto Chorus. The chorus presents The Immigrant Story Wednesday evening at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center. Mary Alice Tierney will narrate the performance. There is more information at WUWM.com. That's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next. ¶¶